There's over 40 million gallons a day in water runoff. That's just water just going into the ocean, where it could be sent somewhere, in my opinion, to somewhere that could need it.
Alaskan communities prepare to export fresh water to the rest of the world. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 26th of July. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the Anchorage mayor backs out of a deal to preserve wild land in the city.
Is this really the best way to spend almost $3 million of municipal funds?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
A federal appeals court panel heard oral arguments on the Juneau Access Road today. A lower court ruled that the decision to go ahead with a highway along the coast of Lynn Canal violated the National Environmental Policy Act because it didn't properly analyze what could be done with the ferry system as an alternative. The state argued that the decision was legal. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
They call it the Juneau Access Project, and it's been a political football for decades. The environmental impact statement for the construction project to link the state capital to the Continental Road System came out late in the administration of former Governor Tony Knowles, but he froze all action on it. It would have eaten up most of the state's share of federal highway money. By the time the project had been revived during the Murkowski administration, federal officials had ruled out the section of road closest to Skagway and Haines, because it had to cross protected land. So another analysis was done, this time coming up with a preferred alternative involving a shuttle ferry to move vehicles between the end of the road and the two towns on the road system. Environmental groups sued, and ultimately District Court Judge John Sedgwick agreed with them that the environmental impact statement did not include enough analysis of what could be done with state ferries. The state argued to the appeals court that it did. Assistant Attorney General Sean Lynch said the law requires a reasonable range of alternatives, and that range did cover all the possibilities of using the ferry system. He said the ferries basically run at maximum capacity at all times, so any more ferry service for Haines and Skagway would have to be taken from somewhere else. Arguing the case for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council and the other plaintiffs, Attorney Kate Glover said, "Wait a minute, what about those shuttle ferries? How can the state say it doesn't need to analyze what it can do with the ferry system while at the same time requiring shuttle ferries? They would have to come from somewhere."
And certainly we don't think it's the right solution is reducing service elsewhere, but the problem is that everything the state's looking at doing would have that effect.
All three judges on the panel had questions of both sides. Judge Richard Clifton said the court's job was to decide whether the state had analyzed the ferry system, and it seemed to him that they had. Glover responded that there was no actual analysis of what could be done with the entire fleet of ferries as the fleet exists. Attorney Lynch argued for the state that things are always changing in the world of ferries, and all the state could do was take a snapshot of the system at a given time and work with that. He said there were two such snapshots from the time of the original EIS in 1997, and then a second one from when the supplemental EIS was written in 2006. The conclusion, using either one of them, is that a road is a better alternative. With a $500 million price tag and the Federal Highway Administration choosing not to participate in the appeal, the environmental groups are asking if it wouldn't be better if, as the legislature plans for new ferries, it kept the Lynn Canal route in mind. That appears to be a political rather than a legal question. Glover says already work is proceeding on the next generation of ferries, the Alaska-class ferries, with the money already budgeted.
And I think that was a great decision. I'd like to see the state use those new boats to help out ferry service everywhere in Southeast Alaska.
But Sean Lynch pointed out that other vessels in the ferry fleet are reaching the end of their design life. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
In rapidly expanding nations like India, Pakistan, and China, disputes are heating up over a scarce and precious resource, water. The presence of fresh water shapes a region's health and agriculture, and control of this resource can determine who has electrical and political power. Alaska, with its many rivers and glaciers, is positioned to become a major freshwater distributor, and two towns across the state are working to monetize their water supplies. Reporters Ed Ronco and Alexandra Gutierrez have the story, beginning with Ed Ronco in Sitka.
Some communities in Alaska say they have more fresh water than they know what to do with. And in Sitka, that water comes from Blue Lake. The city holds a permit to export 95 billion gallons of it every year. That's billion with a B. And the idea is to sell the water in bulk amounts to overseas customers in regions of the world where fresh water is hard to come by. Gary White is director of the Sitka Economic Development Association and the city's point person on bulk water.
I literally spend probably 3 hours a day dealing with people on bulk water and trying to educate myself more about it, because there's just so much going on.
What's been going on lately is a flood of national publicity, including the cable news network CNBC, which is taping a segment here for a special on water. The city of Sitka right now has a contract with a company called True Alaska Bottling. The city is charging that company a cent per gallon for the water. If True Alaska takes all the water it's allowed to take under the contract, it could mean $95 million a year for Sitka.
Frankly, I don't think that will ever happen.
Again, Gary White.
The state only allows us to export 33.6 million gallons per day, because we don't want to come in here and obviously drop that level of the lake. And that's like less than 1% of the volume of the lake that can come out of there. By the time you bring one of these big ships in, tie it up, throw your 33.6 in there a day, I don't think you can realize all of the 95 billion gallons unless you had two loading stations.
But still, full capacity or not, it's a lot of money for a city where the annual general fund revenue is about $24 million. Okay, the companies are interested, the water's available, and the city has every reason in the world to get it going. So what's the holdup? Infrastructure, namely the tanker ships that would carry the water overseas.
They draft about 60 to 80 feet of water. And so we have to have the infrastructure that can allow a ship to come in to that depth.
The plan at the moment is to let companies build that infrastructure and then give them a discount on the water. But right now, there's no way to get the water into a tanker ship. That's not the case in Adak, where KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez picks up the story.
Sitka and Adak have little in common. They're 1,600 miles apart, and where Sitka is a vibrant fishing center, Adak is almost a ghost town. The island was built to house thousands when its military base was in operation, but today the population is estimated to be about 300. The Aleut Corporation has a big stake in Adak. The Native Regional Corporation now owns Adak's former military facilities, which include reservoirs and a deep water port. Now it wants to put them to use exporting bulk water to Asia. Its 37 shareholders across the Aleutian Islands and the Alaska Peninsula would be among the people benefiting from the project. Tony Kange is the president of the Aleut Corporation's real estate division. He says Adak's situation is a reverse of Sitka's.
We're kind of backwards. We know we've got this infrastructure. I've got 12-inch pipes that go down to loading docks, several large piers. I mean, you can put an aircraft carrier in there, and I'm sure they have at some point. So we can fit 300 to 500-foot vessels in there easily. The infrastructure is there. It's coming along. Now it's just a matter of the water rights applications together and being granted the export certificate.
Though the Aleut Corporation first talked about exporting Adak's fresh water in 2000, it only applied for bulk removal permits earlier this month. The Alaska Department of Natural Resources now needs to make sure that Adak has enough excess water that things like the fish population won't be affected by its removal. While the process normally takes about a year, Kange is hoping that the corporation's applications can be expedited so it can start exporting water as soon as January. Some of that fresh water will be sent to India and used for farming, but most will be shipped to China and bottled for sale to China's growing middle class. Kange thinks that Adak will only be exporting about 40 million to 60 million gallons in its first year, but in its applications, the corporation asked to remove up to 500,000 gallons a day from each of the island's three reservoirs, Lakes Betty, DeMarie, and Bonnie Rose. And that's still just a fraction of the island's freshwater runoff, Kange says.
There's over 40 million gallons a day in water runoff. That's just water just going into the ocean where it could be sent somewhere, in my opinion, to somewhere that could need it.
It's not clear whether ADAC or Sitka will develop its water supply first, but in the meantime, the demand for bulk water across the globe is only growing. In Unalaska, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
And I'm Ed Ronco in Sitka.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a rare sighting in a northwest Alaskan village.
When we got there, it was in the water, swimming around. We were all amazed. Everybody in my boat was amazed.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
The Great Land Trust and the municipality of Anchorage have locked horns over 60 acres of wild land, including fragile wetlands. The land, now in private ownership, was to be purchased by the trust and then donated to the city of Anchorage as a park. The trust has raised almost $7 million for the purchase, and the city was to put up $2.7 million for the project. But a week and a half ago, Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan decided to pull the city's money out of the deal. Great Land Trust Executive Director Phil Shepard says he can't understand the city's position.
And this property had been identified as a priority property for the municipality because it's right on the banks of Campbell Creek, which is the largest watershed in Anchorage, and it would provide coastal access to the Anchorage Coastal Wildlife Refuge, both of which were high priorities for the citizens of Anchorage and have been for over 10 years.
Shepard says the parcel of land is noted in the municipality's 2020 development plan in numerous instances after a series of public meetings was held to identify open spaces. The land is in pristine condition because it was held by two old Anchorage families. Now the families wish to sell it.
We've raised the money to purchase the property, to do a park plan, to do infrastructure development, to do all the cleanup of the property, and to annually monitor the property. And the municipality's part would be the modest cost of upkeep, which might include, you know, emptying a trash can once a week. There would be almost no maintenance on the property because it would be 99% a natural area, but there would be almost no cost to maintaining the project.
But the city's $2.7 million contribution is crucial. That money is designated for wetlands projects, but Mayor Dan Sullivan says there are other projects in the city that need completion, too. Sullivan said today that the park project was undertaken during a previous city administration.
Is this really the best way to spend almost $3 million of municipal funds? And do we have the resources to adequately maintain and manage what would be the additional parkland? And part of the land is actually a very prime home site land.
Sullivan says park or not, the wetlands portion of the land will always be protected under law, but the city needs more money on the tax rolls.
Given the fact that we're virtually out of developable land in Anchorage, develop the upper portion into some, you know, literally estate-type homes or maybe cluster housing where you kind of concentrate the housing and have even more green space.
Mayor Sullivan says the city is looking at the possibility of splitting the land between high-end development and the wetlands. He says he's meeting with the Anchorage Community Development Authority, an entity which works with the city to make development purchases, to see if a partnership with the Great Land Trust can be worked out.
And one of the challenges when you're in tough budget times is maintaining your existing assets. And part of that, of course, is if we take this as a park, then we have to maintain it. We have to make sure that, you know, there's funds for liabilities, for damage to the area, which, you know, quite frankly, our Parks Department has indicated they're really not keen on taking on more assets because they're very, very challenged maintaining the assets they have now.
Shepard says more than 100 private donors and organizations like Ducks Unlimited, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Rasmussen Foundation have helped fund the park idea. If a compromise with the city can't be reached, the grant funds and donations will have to be returned. A polar bear showed up well south of its usual territory last week. One was seen in the lower Yukon River near the Bering Sea village of Imonik. That's a village in the northern part of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
Polar bears don't normally show up near Imonik, but one was just a few miles away from the village on Tuesday.
Everybody was all excited and because we never did see a polar bear down here before.
Philomena Keyes is actually from Kotlik, north of Amonik. She was in Amonik to pick up her mom, and while she was there, she heard about the bear over the VHF radio.
We're having doubts that we'd see it, but we went anyways. I was thinking it was on the land, but when we got there, it was in the water, swimming around. I know, we were all amazed. Everybody in my boat was amazed.
She says there were a few other boats there already. Everyone had their cell phones out taking pictures of the bear. Although Keyes, who is 28, had never heard of anyone ever seeing a polar bear near either Amonik or Kotlik, other sightings have been documented. Gene Peltola Jr. is manager of the Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge, and he grew up in Bethel.
If I had to put a time frame on it, I'd imagine we get reports anywhere from 3, 6, 7 to 8 years or so on the Delta. And so they're not really frequent, but they do occur.
In fact, the refuge has heard reports about polar bear sightings on the region's coast over the past month. The bears were seen near Scammon Bay, Hooper Bay, and Nunamaqua.
Just based on the timing of these reports over a short period of time, more recently, there's a potential to have more than one bear out there, but it's not confirmed.
Peltola says polar bears traveling south to the YK Delta depend on how the ice conditions are on the coast.
This spring, especially down by the bottom mouth of the Yukon, and throughout the rest of the coast, we had a series of large northerly winds, and with the ice pack as such, those winds could have caused ice to break off and come close to shore.
Even though it's not unheard of, polar bears' range is typically much farther north. Assistant manager at the refuge, Patrick Snow, used to live in Kotzebue in northwest Alaska and said the bears weren't common there either. He never saw one, but heard about it happening.
They had sightings of them coming down from the Point Hope area down towards Kotzebue. And when that happens, you had similar reportings like you do here. You get word over the VHF and word of mouth and people talking.
As for this latest polar bear near Amonik, it could still be around. Key says no one made a move to harvest the bear as far as she knows.
Everybody just watched it. And after we left, I guess it went up on the land and into the trees, and they just left it. They just let it go.
She says there are a lot of fish camps in the area, but everyone is already done putting up salmon for the year. It is legal for natives living on the coast to kill polar bears for subsistence purposes. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. 90% of those who drown in boating accidents in Alaska are men. To get men to wear their life jackets, have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Go to pledgetolive.org to get a card or find one at your local car Safeway. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety Program.
Today is the first anniversary of Sean Parnell's tenure in the governor's office. He says the transition has been easy once he got past the job of ending the national media attention centered on the office. He says that allowed him to focus on the more important task of trying to bring the state together again.
I was able to just begin fresh, new, focus on our economy, focus on our families, moving forward with the legislative agenda and package along those lines. And I think to that extent, we've made some real progress.
Parnell has also tried to unify the state's delegation in Washington, D.C. Congressman Don Young says that's one of the highlights of the governor's first year.
I think the best thing that the Governor Parnell has done is he talks to people and he listens. I think that's a real positive thing.
Parnell says he's focused on dealing with what's important to him, not what has been important in the past. He refers to the merit-based scholarship program, changes to the educational system, and the fight against domestic violence.
I've taken on a number of initiatives that clearly have my own signature, but at the same time, I am who I am.
Parnell says that part of making the transition into the governor's office was continuing his practice of talking to as many people as possible, even those who disagree with him. Parnell has 6 opponents in the Republican primary that will be held August 24th. Finding safe, clean, and affordable housing continues to be a major challenge in Juneau. A recent report from the Juneau Economic Development Council shows housing prices in the capital city have increased significantly over the last decade, while incomes have remained relatively flat. 34% of Juneau households qualify as housing burdened, meaning they spend more than 30% of their income on rent or mortgage. As KTOO's Casey Kelly reports, efforts are underway to address the problem.
The Juneau Economic Development Council has always tracked housing as part of its economic indicator reports. But Affordable Housing Coordinator Scott Chambor says the Juneau Housing Needs Assessment is the first comprehensive look at the city's housing market.
This report digs a little deeper to figure out exactly what type of needs and what populations need to be assisted in terms of affordable housing.
Generally speaking, anyone who spends more than 30% of their income on housing is considered housing burdened. In 2009, Chambor says that was roughly a quarter of Juneau households.
If you think about the other economic responsibilities of a household, that is kind of the threshold where housing becomes excessive.
The housing industry also defines affordable in terms of rent or mortgage subsidies. To qualify for those, a person or family must make less than 80% of the area median income annually. In 2009, Chambor says Juneau's AMI was $64,000 for a family of four and $44,800 for a single person. One of the city's biggest needs is more rental housing to serve those populations. The vacancy rate for all one- or two-bedroom apartments is around 4.6%, below the national standard of 5%. But if you're low income, the vacancy rate for subsidized apartments is 1 to 2%.
So what you find is low-income persons have a difficulty getting into low-income apartments, but then they don't have many options on the market either.
Juneau also continues to lack affordable homes with three or more bedrooms. The median value of a home in Juneau is about $295,000, 53% higher than the national average and 30% higher than the state average. The vacancy rate for those homes is also comparatively low. Chambor says JEDC has identified about 1,000 renters who can afford to purchase a home but haven't because their options are limited.
There are a bunch of renters who potentially could be homeowners, yet because of the lack of affordable single-family homes, they're not moving into those homeownership roles. They're staying in rental units and occupying potential spaces that other folks could be in.
Like the rest of the country, home building in Juneau took a hit with the national recession. From 1992 through 2006, the CBJ Community Development Department permitted an average of 183 new dwelling units per year. That went down to 97 in 2007 and 58 in each of the last 2 years. Community Development Director Dale Pernula says so far in 2010, the number is 46.
So it is on the rebound, but it's there could be some improvement as well.
Though he urges caution, Pernula expects new home building will continue to rebound as the economy improves.
Our economy, compared to much of the rest of the country, it's not doing too bad. Our unemployment rate is not as high as much of the rest of the country. And perhaps the opening of the Kensington Mine might have something to do with it as well.
The CBJ Assembly last week created an affordable housing fund to help local developers meet the need for more housing. Similar funds have been created all over the country, but Chambor says Juneau has the first one in Alaska.
A lot of those state and national funders want to see some sort of community buy-in or some investment as well. And so the idea is that this local housing fund could serve as that financial piece of a project.
The Assembly seeded the fund with $400,000. The city's Affordable Housing Commission, which Chambor serves on, will develop criteria for project funding, solicit requests for proposals, and make recommendations to the Assembly. Traditional developers of low-income and affordable housing like the Juneau Housing Trust, Tlingit and Haida Regional Housing Authority, and Housing First are expected to apply, but Chambor hopes some commercial developers will also take advantage.
Affordable housing industry, the way it works now is it's all about collaboration. So we're hoping to find private developers who may have a property who are like, hey, instead of just building houses like I normally do, maybe I'll look into what the community needs.
Chambor says the commission will look to state and federal grant programs to keep the fund growing. He also plans to update the housing needs assessment annually so developers can use it as a reference when applying for grants of their own. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Delta Junction celebrated its 50th anniversary yesterday with a look back and some encouraging words about the future. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Hundreds of people, old-timers, newcomers, and visitors all packed Delta's City Park on Sunday to celebrate the town and hear about its history. Delta Mayor Mary Leith Dowling, whose family moved to the town in 1960, said there wasn't much to see then.
Those of us that came here and forever ago, 1960, came to a spot in the road that they were just making into a city.
But since then, it's become a transportation hub at the junction of the Richardson and Alaska highways and the Delta and Tanana rivers, bisected by the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. The pipeline transformed sleepy Delta in the mid-1970s, followed by the rise of an agriculture industry and more recently mining in the form of the Pogo gold mine.
So this town has grown up a bit in the time that some of us have been here.
But the mainstay of the area's economy has always been Fort Greely. Lieutenant Colonel Chris Cronus, the post commander, reminded the crowd at the park of the common history between Delta and the World War II era army camp and airfield that became Fort Greely in 1955. The history between the fort and the town was briefly interrupted in 1995 when Fort Greely was BRAC'd, shut down by the federal base realignment and closure process. Greeley's closure hammered Delta's economy. The downturn lasted until the post partially reopened in 2001, when it was selected as the main site of the nation's ballistic missile defense system.
Fort Greeley proudly serves as an integral part of the nation's ballistic missile defense system, and it is a national security asset. It is one of a kind, and there is no other installation and no other weapon system anywhere else in the United States Department of Defense that you can find that's like the one at Fort Greeley.
Cronus said ongoing work at the missile site and a multi-million-dollar renovation project now underway at Fort Greeley suggests it's likely that the post will be open for business for quite a while.
And this is a great indication that Fort Greeley and Delta Junction are going to be neighbors far into the future. And I envision the Fort Greeley commander standing here 5 decades from now helping you celebrate your 100th anniversary.
In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaskan News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco in Sitka, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.